In the great hall of Morias, the tribe of the gods are having a grand feast celebrating the 7th year of rule for King Nuada. Mead is flowing, music is being sung, and laughter is all around. Suddenly, a piercing scream brought everything to a halt. All the light vanished from the room. Uscaeus, the fair seer, eyes rolled back until only white showed. His voice came not from his throat, but from the air itself, cold as the northern winds. The thread of your days grows thin. Too long have you lingered in comfort while destiny slips away. If the green isle beyond the western waters remains untaken by your hands, if her sacred soil never knows the weight of your feet, then the Tuatha De will become smoke upon the wind. Rule in the halls of the Blessed Isle, or fade to nothing beneath the forgotten stars. This is the quest for power.
Welcome to the Quest for Power, where we are rating and reviewing the mythical, legendary, and historical characters of the Celtic, Norse, and Germanic traditions of Europe. As always, I am your unreliable narrator, Michael, and my favorite Chaos Goblin and DM, who is joining me on this adventure is...
Roberto.
Roberto, you were not a fan of the last guy. Do you remember everything you hated?
I mean, seeing how I just edited it, like, 20 minutes ago... So you had this little princeling who was like, oh my gosh, I want to be king, but daddy won't let me be king, so I'm going to cause trouble. So he started causing trouble, but the thing is, he was a little Greek princeling, so he decided to get an army of people and just kind of cause mayhem around his dad's kingdom. Then his dad was like, I can't banish him or execute him, but I'll marry him off and have him live with his wife in Egypt. So he does so. Then, lo and behold, the plague of locusts and everything bad happening in Egypt happens, because guess what? It is a time of Moses. So because of that, he ends up having to leave Egypt, flying around like a bat out of hell. And he ends up going along the coast of northern Africa and then skirting around the coast of Iberia until he gets to A Coruña. You know, it takes him about 40 years to get there. And then he establishes a little fortification there. And then his sons go off to genocide a whole island, and then he dies, and he wasn't even on Ireland, so I don't even know why we ranked him.
That would be because it is one of the originations of Scotland, and it's all going to come together eventually.
Yeah, but like, he never set foot in the area, man.
Yeah, unfortunate, but he is an ancestor and always talked about. At least in the sources that I've been reading.
I mean, I guess...
That was a spot-on, like, summary. I think that was one of your best ones.
It's like I just listened to it 20 minutes ago, really Michael. Is.
That was incredible.
I just literally edited it 20 minutes ago.
That's so funny. So with that, we're going to go back into time. Into time before memory, the world was young and magic flowed like rivers throughout the land. In this magical whirlpool arose four mighty cities in the distant northern lands. Their names, Phalias, Gorias, Bindias, and Murias, of great prowess. I forgot to say bright Gorias. Within these sacred cities dwelt the Tuatha De, who pursued the arts, knowledge, and mysteries of the world with fierce, unrelenting passion. Four sages held dominion over these cities. Morpheus, the poet, presided over Phalias. It was said he could reshape reality with verse and his words alone. His words spoke the creation of Lea Fael, or Stone of Destiny, as some of us have heard of it, and it would cry out with a voice of thunder beneath the rightful feet of a king. Esaras, of keen desires, commanded the mysteries of Gorias. It was said that he was the embodiment of fiery passion, unrelenting ambition. In the forges, deep under Murias, Esaras crafted a spear that crackled with lightning and had deadly precision and always hit its target. Usias, the fair seer, gazed into the veils of time from impossibly high towers of Findias. In his towers, it is said he wove reality until he crafted the Sword of Light, which is essentially a druidic lightsaber, a weapon for a more civilized time. In Murias, Samaeth, the Everfear, sat on a gilded throne, and he wielded wisdom like a blade. He created the greatest wonder of all, True Thing of Wisdom, the Cauldron of Plenty, an inexhaustible cauldron that created unlimited food and could heal any wound and even restore the dead to life.
So where is this cauldron now? Because I would love to have that.
I would as well. That would be pretty awesome. It is lost. Probably in the other world where it currently still is. So somewhere in Ireland, beneath Ireland, and yet within Ireland, if that makes
both,
sense.
It is Schrodinger's Ireland. It is both in Ireland and not in Ireland.
Correct. It's the other world, which is, again, in Ireland, yet outside Ireland.
Don't you give up on it. Another world awaits you.
I don't know if you noticed, but there are forges deep in Murias, and there's a little, you know, nice little deep cavern of Murias.
In the mines of Moria! I noticed.
And Tolkien says he doesn't like Celtic. No.
My cousin will host a great feast for us in Moria.
It's so funny when we go into a lot of Irish stuff, I'm like, oh, that's from Tolkien. Or he took that. Oh, George R. R. Martin took that one. Anyway, the Tuatha De took the words of their seer very seriously, and all four cities were abandoned, with the exception of the sages who stayed behind to kind of fold into history. And it is said that Samaeth ceremoniously gave the Dagda, the great god, and he presented him with the artifact of Cauldron of Plenty. So if you want to know who has it, currently this god has it in the other world. Morpheus presented Nuta with the Stone of Destiny, in which he cried out when he himself stepped on it 7 years earlier. Usias then ceremoniously removed the Sword of Light from his side and gave it to Nuta. Esaras gave the Spear of Gorias to Manaman MacLir, telling him that not for him, but the time would come, and he would know exactly who to give it to.
Me! I wanted to make it into a pick of destiny.
Yeah, I'm interested to see if in our D&D campaign, if any of these artifacts ever show up. Granted, we're so low level that artifacts would not be a thing. But you never know.
I would never bring these artifacts into D&D. Now, there's something I always bring into D&D, which I may tell you about.
Uh-oh.
Have you heard of the goose?
I have not.
We've already had a goose, so.
A goose?
It's a goose. I always bring a goose. It's an animal.
Ah, our friend.
The Goose of Mayhem.
The Goose of Mayhem? What?
You'll find out eventually.
Is this a player character or an NPC?
It's a DM character.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I'm the Chaos Goblin. Should know this by now.
And after that little ceremony, all four sages drained the islands of all of their magic, and they created a swirling dark mist, and it enveloped the entirety of the Tuatha De, and it sent them into the Blessed Isle before the sages faded to nothing. They used all of their magic.
Okay, so let's rate them. All right, royal power.
Meanwhile, remember the Nemedians, children of Nemed, the non-existent king? Well, his children...
Is it the one that I always forget about?
Probably. Yeah, I don't know if you recall, but there were 30 survivors after his episode.
You know, I did hear that last episode and immediately went, that's not important.
Well, anyway, those 30 survivors were struck by an unnatural storm.
And now there's none.
Their sails were smashed up along with many of their oars, and they were at the complete mercy of the sea.
And then they went hungry and began eating each other.
I mean, they could have. They could have. On their way of cannibalism, they eventually, the storm carried them magically, by the grace of God, all the way to Thrace. Because that makes sense.
So we went from Ireland all the way back to Greece.
Yep.
So we did a switcheroo with the peeps.
I'm getting the feeling that these Irish monks didn't really know anything else besides the Mediterranean and Greece for some reason. They had an obsession with Greece. I wonder if they just got done reading the Iliad and they're like, we need to really force Greece into our narrative.
I mean, you used to have to like know the classics in Greek for a long time, Michael.
Yep,
like well into the 1900s. So the obsession never left.
Eventually, the storm smashed them up against the rocks, destroyed any hope of repairing them.
Abandon all hope who enter here.
Boy, it sounds like we've both been listening to too much Critical Role lately. Anyway.
That's from Iced Earth, the band.
Oh, I don't know who that is.
They have a song about Dante's Inferno, which is badass.
That would be pretty good.
It's a 16-minute long song, and I remember as a teenager, I listened to it enough times that I got it to 666 total listens.
That's amazing. I hope you never listen to it again.
Not on Apple. Not on iTunes.
Anyway, the refugees were immediately accosted by the kings and champions of the land. But instead of war breaking out, an accord was struck. In their overwhelming generosity, the Greeks gave the refugees lands where their ships were smashed ashore. A completely rocky hellscape, sharp cliffs, deep ravines, and arid soil, if you could call it soil.
You can settle that land there, but only where you have debris. But
pretty much.
But excuse me, that I can't grow anything on there. Up, this is my land, and I'm giving you what I can give you.
Yeah,
you take what you can and deal with it. But sorry, no buts. Take it or die.
Historically accurate conversation that definitely happened.
See here, Kyrelios, if I give them this land, they're going to die anyways. I just don't feel bad about executing them. Ah, yes, Agathios, good job.
Even Greek names, I love it. Mm-hmm. And despite this brutal arrangement, they made it work. They're hardworking people. They began toiling when the sun arose from its slumber until they could see no more. They transported these large amounts of soil by hand using these large leather bags, literally remaking the landscape by hand into the best fertile land of the region.
Agathios, did we give them leave to get our soil? Well, King Kyrelios, we didn't tell them we couldn't. Ah, shit.
Well, the kings and warriors saw this, and they're like, that land's better than my land.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Yeah, taking a little, a page out of the old American book, they're like, no, actually, this is our land now. You get to go on to a different land.
All the way from Corinth to the Aegean Isles.
They would set them into another rocky hellscape, and this would continue over and over and over again for over two centuries. The Numidians had dealt with this.
So we're just skipping 200 years, Michael.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we started in the land before time. So, I mean,
so
what's 200 years in the land of infinite?
See, now you said the land before time, and I'm just imagining they're all dinosaurs.
There you go. Yep. I should, Andrea would love that reference.
Oh, Ducky. Oh, bless your heart. I'm sorry what happened to you.
I only remember the pterodactyl. I forgot his name already.
Ducky was a little tiny, like, kid dinosaur. Like, the tiny one.
I don't remember that one for some reason.
Yeah,
I watched it for a whopping 5 minutes and then ran away.
No, you gotta watch it with Leo now. Sorry.
Yeah.
Andrea would love that, so.
Yeah, I'm sure once we go through the Disney thing, trust me, we will be listening and watching every single Disney movie there is.
It's not a Disney movie, Michael.
Animated show.
Animated film. The Don Bluth movie, thank you very much.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Eventually, one family had enough, and they were known as the Sons of Dela. Rari, Ginnan, Gon, Sling of the Spears, and Sengon were his five sons.
Hey, Gon and Sengon are back. I remember that one.
Except for they're no longer Fomorians, they're Nemedians.
Well, see, the thing is, they probably populated with Fomorians for a bit.
Yeah, that's probably correct. That would not surprise me.
So now they're half fish people and half whatever they were originally.
Half Scythians? I think they took off from Scythia.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
Somewhere in the Mediterranean. They secretly began making boats out of their leather sacks, and they started stashing them away, hidden from the views of the kings and champions of the land. Then, under the cover of darkness, in a coordinated attack, they slew everyone in the harbor guarding the Greek fleet. And at the same time, multiple groups attacked several settlements at once, slaughtering not just the men, but the women and the children, too. They slaughtered
Anakin
them
killed
like
the, not just the men, but the women and the children, too. Anakin would never do such a thing, Padme.
And after the streets were good and soaked in blood, they stole everything not nailed down, torched the towns, surrounding fields, and the night was lit up by firestorms that swept through the land.
You would not believe your eyes if 10 million fireflies lit up the world as the Greeks fell asleep.
It's a horrific, beautiful sight. They loaded up on a fleet of stolen ships and bag boats, as they're called, with their plunder and sailed off into the darkness, allowing the stars and the gods to guide their way.
I would like to make myself believe the Fomorians are calling me.
Eventually, the fleet made its way to Spain.
España!
And when they landed in Spain, they were not accosted on both sides. In fact, they were treated to a grand feast.
You there! What are you doing here? You look like you're hungry. Come eat with us. We have paella, we have wine, we have everything you could want.
Have you been in Spain? Eat more.
My family's from freaking Spain, originally.
What?
We're descended from Spaniards. I literally have a town with my last name on it.
You've never told me this. You've told me Cuba.
Yes, I mean, my family's from Cuba, descended from Spain. We have a town called Toro, which is near Madrid, where my family's from.
Okay, this is a whole thing of bag. All right, we gotta unpack this one later on in life. I probably was within that city too. Anyway,
probably not.
We went to a lot of weird little cities around there. Anyway, during the feast, the Sons of Dela spoke with the local druids, and they learned how to use the winds to get back to Ireland. So the druids must have known about Ireland and Spain. So it could have been the descendants or the people of Githelas from last episode. It could have been his enemies. Who knows? After the feast, they thanked their gracious hosts, and they actually sailed off to the Promised Land, carried off by the southwest winds. However, in the dark of night, violent storms suddenly struck. Massive waves smashed against the ships, and the fleet once again scattered.
There do be a Kraken!
On the first day of August, Slane was
on the first day of August, my true love said to me.
Your true love sent you to make landfall on the southeast of the island and claimed the land of modern-day Leinster.
On the first day of August, my true love said to me, go claim Leinster.
And on the second week, Gon and Ginnan were carried ashore. And Gon was carried to the southwest, and he landed in northern Munster. Ginnan was pushed far north of his brother until he was able to steer his ships into Connacht.
And then my brothers left me.
Finally, on Tuesday, the last of the brothers made it to the Emerald Isle. Ruari made it to the northeast in Ulster, and Sengon was sent exactly opposite of the island, and his people were forced to land in the southern coast of Munster.
Okay. I only have one thing to say to this.
Yes.
And I, you know, I am here to just say, a nation once again, a nation once again, and I no longer province be a nation once again.
So at first, imagine this. They landed in these islands. They can't exactly text each other, hey bro, where'd you land at? So they sent messengers across the island in hopes that each of their other brothers made it. And eventually some sort of communication network was formed, and they agreed to meet at an old abandoned fortress on the Hill of Tara in Leinster.
Hey bro, you up?
Bro, you dead?
1v1, no, quick scope, no scope on dust.
And when the kings arrived to the fortress, they were shocked to see this ageless man who just oozed with raw power standing behind the ancient throne of Tara, where Nemed once sat in Partholon before him. In a commanding voice, the man has said, I have foreseen this day for a long, long time. Too much suffering and death has plagued this island over the power of this very seat and the sovereignty of this land. You, the sons of Nemed, must elect one man to rule over you all. I foresee that if you murder the High King, you will break Agesa, and inevitable doom and destruction will follow.
Is this the druid from the first episode with,
Fintan?
Fintan, yeah.
Yeah, Fintan?
Is it Fintan?
It is Fintan or whatever. Yeah.
Is it?
Yep, it is.
Oh, shit! He's back!
Do you know what Agesa is?
I guess you want me to guess about it?
Sure, go for it.
I can't Agesa a thing.
Oh. It's essentially a magical binding placed on you. If you break it, you're fucked. And you're probably gonna dead, and your entire kingdom's gonna collapse. It's like the unbreakable vow in Harry Potter, but it rests on your entire civilization and not just you. The brothers, without hesitation, elected Slain as the first High King of Ireland.
I guess Slain will be slain soon.
And yes, after that formality has taken place, the man introduced himself as Fintan, the husband of the noble Caesar, eternal witness of this island. He created the five provinces that each brother would rule as a petty king under the High King, and then he transformed into an eagle and flew away, having served in narrative.
I mean, that's pretty on brand for Fintan.
Yep. Yeah, it sounds about right.
Like, he transformed into a fish and then swam away, and now he's an eagle. Eagle!
Caw, caw.
They actually don't say caw-caw, caw-caw.
I know.
Yeah, they're a little high-pitched. Yeah, they're little high-pitched guys.
And after all of that work, Slain held the kingship for an entire year, and then became very dead.
All right, who slayed him?
You tell me. He just died.
It was gone and Sen gone. Because they wanted Slain to be gone. And then Sen gone was like, okay.
Well, despite them wanting him to be gone, their brother Ruari took over the High King throne, and he managed to rule for 200% of the time his brother did, and then he too died.
Wow! Look at that! He's already doing so much better. And then the next brother...
And then the brothers Ganon and Gon held the High King together. Very adorable. They must have been twins. And they managed to hold the High Kingship for 400% of the time of their original brother Slain.
4 years?
And then plague swept through the land and slew them both. So that leaves Sengon. He's the last remaining son of Dela. And the most important thing he did during his reign was have sex with his wife, Anust. And she gave him a boy named Srin. And then his reign abruptly ended when his nephew, Fiaka, Senophon, son of Starn, son of Ruari, snuck up behind him holding what looked like a pretty dark and sinister dagger. And he slit his neck open.
And Now Fintan's thing's gonna come up and happen.
And he left the king choking on his own blood as his soul left his body in the halls of Tara. And that is Fiaca Xenophon became the very first king to claim the position of High King of Ireland through bloodshed.
Of course.
And as we have found out already, this is going to be a common thing.
And then the Thayer's curse begins officially.
And then in the dark of night, Rinnal, son of Ganon, stood over him, his brethren, holding the very sinister dagger that he held before. And he impaled his heart, nailing him to the bed for the servants to find the next day.
You know, is this what we're going to... Are you going to keep describing deaths until we get to Jochen MacEirc?
Whoa. First of all.
I just see people stabbing each other and stabbing more.
So, like, Rinnal, he actually managed to rule for 6 years. So, you know, he actually did well.
Oh, okay. 6 years, Michael.
Yeah, we just don't know what he did during those 6 years.
Okay, then, he died.
Yeah, he was cut down by Fogburn, who then seized the throne for himself.
And then how long did Fogburn rule for, and when did he die? Or how did he die?
So he was in the fourth year of his reign, and all of a sudden he was surrounded by Eocade MacEirc.
Oh, finally!
And his heirs. They penetrated his defenses.
They penetrated him, all right.
Yeah, they did. The clash of steel and echoes crossed through the halls of Ireland. And in the chaos of battle...
Don't stab me! Don't stab me! Get the dagger away from me as he ran through the halls. Get away from me! Get away from me! I don't want to die! I don't want to die!
And then he okayed, plunged the dagger into him.
No, he tossed the dagger at him into his back.
There you go.
And he's like, Wilhelm yell.
And then Jochade burned the fortress down, seized loot and slaves.
Burning it all down, we're burning it all down, I'm burning it all down and taking all the slaves.
So, he had himself a night.
He definitely had a crazy night. Did you? And the next morning, hey, did you guys hear there's a crazy fire at the fortress? Like, I don't know how that happened. My dagger's missing. Someone stole it from me and they, oh my god, the guy before me is dead. Oh. Do you want me to be High King now? I guess I have to take this honor. You know, I can't say no to this.
Exactly 100% what happened. Yep.
Yeah.
Entire conversation. But, by the way, strange enough.
Put this dagger in a lockbox and bury it deep in the ground.
Yeah. I never want to see that dagger.
I don't want to see this again. If I see it again, you're going to die.
Once he established himself as High King, a crazy thing happened. Peace descended across the land.
For 3 years.
Quite a little bit longer than that.
4 years.
The Firbolg had been suffering, obviously, from these years of infighting. And their domain, which once covered the entirety of Ireland, was now all the way abandoned in the western half. There was just ruins and dust gathering in the western half of Ireland. And they started, you know, they kind of left themselves in the eastern lands. And in the early years, we finally have a real woman that we can talk about and have some information about. He married the goddess Telitu, daughter of Megmor. Megmor means great plain. So in all likelihood, he married a literal earth goddess herself.
He's really going for that oath of devotion, isn't he?
Oh, he did pretty freaking well. This is a thing in like stories where the marriage between kingship and land is often done over and over and over again in Ireland. And This is kind of representing that sacred bond. But Marrying an earth goddess has some really good benefits.
Man, you're dating you're fucking an actual goddess.
Yeah, I mean, that's for one. Yeah, that's always going to go well for you. And an earth goddess of fertility, you know.
He's going to have lots of babies.
His reign, probably in no small part to her, is considered the golden era of the Firbolg. And in fact, Queen Telitu leads this massive project of clearing the great forest of County Meath, and she transforms it into Ireland's best farmland to feed her subjects.
Ooh.
We are told in his reign, no rain fell from the heavens, yet the morning dew alone sufficed to water the earth, and every harvest yielded a surplus of crops.
So he basically married the female Garth Greenhand.
Pretty much, yes, exactly.
Okay.
In his time, we are told that falsehoods were banished by the light of his justice, and by his hand, the law of righteousness was first executed in Ireland, establishing order where chaos had reigned. Basically, it sounds like he did a lot of reforms.
Do we know what they are, though?
No. We just know that they say that justice finally, you know, where chaos was, justice finally have. They have some semblance of a structure now.
And justice has prevailed!
Pretty much. And so he was about 10 years into his reign, and he was deep into a dream. And in this dream, he saw a big flock of black birds coming from the depths of the ocean.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take your broken wings and learn to fly.
That's pretty close. The birds attacked his people, brought confusion upon his people, and destroyed his people.
Your life, you're only waiting for this moment to arrive.
But one of the firbolgs struck the noblest of the birds and severed its wing.
Okay. The Beatles knew what they were talking about.
And he woke up in a cold sweat, and, you know, his concerned wife, who was watching her husband shake violently in his sleep for the first time. I mean, they've had a very good life so far for 10 years. And he told her of his dream. And in a nice soothing voice, she encouraged him to bring this dream to his magician, Kessard. However, before he could bring this up to his magician came and knocked on the door, and he told him that their scouts have spotted an unnatural mist descending on the coasts of Connacht in the abandoned west.
The shades of Gondor!
And after Eochaid recounted his dream, the magician cast a divination, and he was absolutely horrified by what he saw.
No, the dream, it's real.
He said, warriors are coming across the sea, 1,000 heroes, a people skilled in every art, including the dark arts. They will come upon us and destroy us, but we will have dealt a mighty blow.
Are these the guys from last episode, the Gales?
You'll find out, won't you?
And next episode of Dragon Ball Z.
Immediately, Eochaid sent out like more scouts, and he wanted to get an idea of what was going on, and he summoned a war council for the first time in 10 years.
Summon the war council.
And one scout came back, had this weird, delighted, yet terrified look on his face. And he said, like in this weird-ass trance, I have seen the gods. These beings were the embodiment of beauty and delight, and at the same time, horror and dread.
Oh, so these are the Greeks.
A hush descended across the council. They were now at a supreme disadvantage, not knowing what the fuck that meant.
These words, what do they mean, Mason?
And from their council rose a decree. Let Sren, son of Sengon, venture forth to observe them. And out stepped in the council this colossal of a man. Even among warriors, it was said that his presence struck terror in the hearts of his enemies.
Okay, Michael, the correct term is this bear of a man. Because that's how every romance novel talks about a man who's a big guy.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I haven't read one of those recently.
I just read one about an ogre and his wife. So
is that a Critical Role one?
Nope.
The Tusks of Love?
Nope, it's Smut.
Oh, okay. So, cold as ice, very confident of himself, Strength armored up. Fascinating. Roberto's holding up a book called My Ogre Husband. I kind of don't want to read it.
It's actual literal written porn, Michael.
You do you.
I got my partner to read it. She read it in 2 hours.
Was that good, huh?
She found it just confusing. I have not read it, and I refuse to.
Probably a good thing. Well, anyway, Sren kind of armored himself up. He grabbed his weapons, and he headed out into the unknown. Meanwhile, The Tuatha De landed in a very foreign land, and they began to set up camp while they adjusted to their new home. And they saw this giant of a man, a bear of a man, if you will, approaching them.
Thank you.
Bress, a mighty champion himself, offered to parley with this giant. He too armored himself up, grabbed his weapons, and he headed out to meet this fearsome warrior. And when the two warriors drew together, they stood within speaking distance. They each looked at each other, yet never spoke a word. And both of them had wonder and astonishment as they beheld the other and the weapons and their appearance. You know that mutual respect between warriors of opposite sides? That bond had already formed between these two men. And finally, at last, they greeted each other as old friends who haven't seen each other for a while. And they exchanged their weapons with the other and talked as warriors did. Finally, after discussing who knows what, Brez asked, "So, Sren, where'd you spend last night?"
"With your wife."
I don't think Sren's trying to start a war at this moment. It's more of a fact-finding mission.
"With your mom."
Sren answered, "At the hollowed heart of Ireland, in the wrath of Kings Imtara, where the kings and princes of the Firbolg and Yokade, High King of Ireland, and whence come from you?" With that, Bress answered, "From the crowdest capacious camp yonder on the mountain slope where the Tuatha De and Nuda, their king who came from the north of world in a cloud of mist and magic to Ireland in the land of the west." And Sren said, "All right, well, it's been fun. I've really enjoyed getting to know you. You sound like a pretty cool dude, but I gotta go back and kind of, you know, tell my people of you in your existence." And Bress looked at him pretty seriously. It was like, "All right, time for business." He said, "You need to tell the Firbolg, your king, that they must either give my people half of Ireland or battle." And Sren replied with grim honesty, "I would honestly rather give you half of Ireland than face your weapons. And on top of that, the two champions made an agreement that no matter what will happen, they will not search each other out on the battlefield, and they will remain friends despite the result of what will come." And then they exchanged weapons, being like, "Here, go show this to your people," and they headed off. And so both men returned to their respective sides, and they made it very clear that it would not be wise to engage the other in battle. For very different reasons. Mm-hmm. Sren was like, "These guys have magic. They're ridiculously powerful. They're going to kick our ass." And Brez said, "These people are hardy. They've got these really horrifying looking weapons. I don't think we should face against them. They're proud warriors. These guys don't back down from a fight." And they're like, "I think peace is the better option at this point." You know, so these guys, they don't fear death or anything like that. And Sren himself, like, really pressed the point home. He said in no uncertain terms that honestly it would be better to give the western half of the island that we already have abandoned to these people. And Eokade firmly denied this. He said, "If they granted that, soon all the land will be theirs."
Oh no. Oh no. Eokade.
And Brez, in his report, made it very clear that the inhabitants of the land were to be taken seriously. Their weapons were quite nasty. They had zero fear of any man, or God for that matter. And he was confident that, honestly, they're not going to back down. And we're honestly going to have a fight. There's no way their people are accepting this.
Which, as you can see, Eokade and Makaric said no.
Yeah, correct. And so with that, the Tuatha De moved to a hill near Magnia, where they would build a fortress to be their base of operations for raiding missions and their new home.
Yeah.
And so this new fortress was built. The Tuatha De received reports that this massive army was heading their way. And the men started arguing over what to do and Just nothing was getting done. And what they didn't see was three young girls who were handmaidens of the Tuatha De, named Maka, Namein, and Bathe. They kind of snuck out of there.
Did you say Maka?
I did say Maka.
Is this the original Maka?
The original Maka technically is Nemed's wife, but yes, I would say this is the original Maka.
Okay.
These daughters are known as the triplets of Ernmas and some unknown man. They're bastards, and they were probably relegated to low handmaidens among the Tuatha De.
You mean we don't know the dad's name? What a surprise!
I know, shocker. Normally you don't know the mother's name, so it actually is kind of a shocker.
Yeah.
This didn't sit well with them. These girls, they wanted to be warriors. They thought that they could even take men on. And so during the long nights in this new foreign land, they began practicing forbidden arts that they managed to sneak from a tome from Gordias that was supposed to have been left behind, because no one should be touching this.
No one, I tell you, no one.
And while the men were arguing over whether to engage the army and try and settle it peacefully, you know, they kept going on at night. The sisters, they snuck out to the knoll of the taking of hostages across the fortress of Magnea and overlooking the army that was gathered there. They had been preparing for this moment for months. Fear clawed at their hearts, their eyes burned with unwavering determination as the wind started howling around them. They each withdrew ruby-encrusted daggers, sliced open their palms, and pressed them together. And through the endless night, they chanted different incantations, three voices interlacing into a single perfect, terrible melody of dominion, death, and destruction.
Cantate Domino omnis terra, cantate Domino mirabilia ignis etis, mirabilia ignis etis.
Yeah, and it continued on and on and on. So by morning, it was discovered that they had gone missing, and they're like, who's supposed to give us wine? The sun was like getting about halfway into the sky, not quite there yet. And then they spotted the girls up on this wacky ass hill, and they were in this like formation, pulling their palms together, which was a little odd. And then the sun reached high noon and fucking disappeared. And an oppressive darkness swept across the realm like an obsidian flood, as though the sun's eternal flame burned out. The three sisters felt their souls ripped away from their bodies and forced into the land around them and the other world hidden within Ireland. Their mortal forms dissolved, their essence swirling in a tempest of crimson mist, and it turned with this unnatural purpose. And out of the red mist formed a woman. No, not a woman. More like an otherworldly sovereign. An entity whose divine form inspired primal carnal desire, lust, and soul-shattering horror and terror. The Morrigan. The Great Queen herself, the Phantom Queen, who will cause chaos and destruction throughout Irish history, has manifested at last. And the only light on the landscape was this otherworldly figure. In an unholy scream that reached out of her mouth, the three maidens split from her, and now they were each like completely different than what they were. They were now goddesses of death, sovereignty, and destruction in one essence together, and they appeared on the hill in a form that was even terrifying to the Tuatha De. And in case things weren't, you know, not going great enough, the obsidian sky split open as the women forced their hands down on the camp below and it released a torrent of arcane energy. They raised their arms as blinding lightning slammed through the Fearbolg camp, and followed by deafening sounds of thunder. The lightning began emitting some sort of magic that engulfed the Fearbolg with visions of seeing tortured faces of their loved ones howling in silent agony. And if this nightmare wasn't bad enough, the heavens opened up and a thick crimson blood poured from the skies. Some warriors would claim that the blood spoke to them. Others claimed it burned like acid. Fire started raining down from the skies onto the camp, and all of the tents were reduced to ash. swords and shields were blackened from the downpour of the magma as the warriors were holding that up. And Yokade, once he finally pulled himself together, went to his sorcerers like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Do something. You know, counterspell? Anything? And the sorcerers began to weave counterspells, and they kept rolling natural ones, and it wasn't working out. This continued for 3 days and three nights, and the Firbolg spirits were grinded into sand. And eventually, finally, on the fourth day, the druids were able to use dispel magic. The war had not begun, but the Morgan claimed their first victory. The Firbolg understood the power against them. Their ranks were reduced to traumatized husks of their former selves, unless they were the lucky ones who were killed. Only true warriors were able to keep their composure.
Well, damn! The Morgan!
And after this magical artillery bombardment, Nuta made one last attempt at peace. King Okade honorably received 3 Tuatha De poets in his royal tent, and they showered him with gifts. But those gifts came with a hook. They reaffirmed, we want half of Ireland. You saw what we can do. An equal division between our people is all we ask. Nothing more and nothing less. Yokade, who was there with his nobles, raised his eyebrows and went, you hear what they're saying? And the nobility replied, yeah, we hear you. They can have the whole of Ireland over our dead bodies. The poets nodded as if they expected this answer along. The poets nodded as if they expected this answer all along. They rubbed their hands together and went, when do we fight?
Right now! And they slayed the poets right then and there. No, they can't do that.
So instead of planning ambushes or surprise attacks, both sides agreed to get the other ready for war. The Tuatha De forged the spears of the Firbolg, and the Firbolg would craft the javelins of the Tuatha De. Both sides created the very weapons that would weeks later kill them or their loved ones.
Sounds stupid, but okay.
Because honor culture.
Still stupid, but okay.
6 weeks passed. And in the high of summer, both sides finally prepared their weapons and they made ready for war. When the appointed day arrived, the Dagda struck the opening blow for the Tuatha De. He carved through Firbolg ranks like a boulder rolling downhill, and behind him, other champions, each cutting their own red path through the enemy. But Kirb of the Firbolg answered with his own devastating charge, and soon this organized, carefully laid out battle shattered into hundreds of personal duels, and it was fought against increasingly blood-soaked grass as each warrior fell. And by the end of the first day, the Tuatha De were forced back to their camp. They lost this first day of battle. But the Firbolg let them go, and they didn't pursue them. Instead, they decided to take the heads of all their enemies and build a great cairn from stones and the heads of their enemies in front of their king. Because, sure. Then both armies, they dragged their wounded to healing wells, and the Firbolg worked with herbs, and the Tuatha De worked with magic, and both sides worked through the night to mend what the war had broken. So the second day brought even fiercer fighting as champions from both sides stepped forward to lead their armies. Ogma and Midir charged for the Tuatha De, while the sons of Slain, the first High King of the Firbolg, answered. And the sound of steel rang and crossed the plains until the swords began snapping against bone and edges of weapons were killing so many people that they started to become dull. And then Sreng, son of Sengon, went, let's just end this. He went looking for King Nuta himself. This is the guy that met Brez in the beginning.
Okay.
In this instant, he punched through the armor of 150 enemy soldiers, and he laved a trail of basically dead gods and champions in his wake. He was after Nuta, and Nuta knew it. Nuta met him with shield in the center of the battlefield, and Nuta, we haven't really talked about him yet, like how his fighting was. He was quick as lightning. He was said to be skilled beyond measure and brave to face any challenge. I mean, he was a king in a warrior culture. He managed to strike Strang 9 times, but Strang's strength was something beyond human understanding. What would have killed a normal human, Strang just shrugged off, and he hammered at Nuda's painted shield with blows that made the earth shake around them until the rim of Nuda's shield cracked and split away entirely. He raised his sword above his head and brought it down, cutting through the armor, cutting through the flesh, and through bone of Nuda's right arm. And it landed on the ground with a sick thud. And the king screamed of pain, as you would, of your arm being sliced off. And this brought Egnba of Norway, because of course they had some Norwegian companion to help them out. Facing two enemies at once, despite that, Strang refused to give ground. He and Egnba fought this, like, desperate fury until both men started bleeding from a dozen wounds. Both men's armor was in tatters, just cuts all across them. And then the Dagda arrived himself to help his wounded king. Sren understood when it was time to walk away. He was a warrior, a proud one, but not a fool. He's too beat up, you know. He did what some D&D parties don't and ran. And then Nagaba, our Norwegian companion, our first red shirt Norwegian companion, died of a fatal wound. I don't know if you've listened to Saga Thing.
Nope.
But those who do will get that reference. Norwegian companions are constantly killed off. It's really funny. And the Tuatha Dé carried their maimed king from the battlefield. Not dead yet, so we won't raid him. In Nuda, he would live, but he would never hold a sword properly again. And this is in a world where kings led from the front lines, and one-handed ruler was no ruler at all. So he's got that going for him.
Which is nice.
And then the third day occurred, and both sides knew that this was going to end one way or another. And they both took as much of their strength as possible, as much of their reserves as possible, and they threw it into what would be the final assault. No mercy, horrific, vicious fighting. King Jokaid actually entered the fighting personally, and he cut down enemy champions with the methodical precision of a man who spent his entire life learning how to kill. And then one of the champions he killed was Ernmas, mother to Nemain, Maka, and Baithe. And as soon as Ernmas fell dead, her blood calling to her children through the earth, three ravens that had been circling the battlefield slammed down into the ground around him. And out of the dust appeared three very, very pissed off, terrifying women that had bright red hair and fire in their eyes. Uh-oh. It was at that moment Jokaid knew he fucked up. No one in the Fearbolg dared to swing their weapons against them. They knew what these women could do, and they weren't going to touch that one. And then they started chanting this horrific chant while just staring daggers into the eyes of the High King. And this mist of chaos was swirling around them, which they wore like cloaks of protection. And then all of a sudden, Jokaid's mouth felt like really old leather. His throat burned with every breath until his tongue stuck to the roof of his mouth. The need for water became more urgent than the need for victory. He was beyond thirsty. And so he told his son, slaying the fair, hold the line here. I need water bad. And so he left the battle with 100 of his best guards, and they were seeking any stream or well or something that would hold water. But while that was going on, three ravens were flying across the battlefield, drying up all the wells with their magic. And even they, though, couldn't make the ocean disappear. A little too powerful for them. So the king reached down to the shoreline with the enemies close behind him. Once they reached the beach, 150 Tuatha Dé warriors poured onto the beach, and suddenly the king's guard found themselves fighting for their lives with their backs pressed against the ocean. Men fell on both sides as swords and spears clashed and found their marks. And the beach finally kind of settled again into single combat. This is the heart of Irish combat, is just constant one-on-one battle. Not like the methodical murder of later phalanx or Roman. It's very warrior-esque life. I don't know how to say it. Iokade kept fighting until the blood in his body started growing thick and gooey, and his blood pressure suddenly dropped, his internal organs failed, and he collapsed onto the blood-soaked sand without a scratch on him. The Morrigan had their revenge, and they killed him with an agonizing death via literal fatal dehydration. That's the life and reign of Iokade, son of Eric, High King of Ireland.
Okay.
Ready to rate him?
Royal power.
So Iokade is considered by far every resource on the Fearbulg is if you see a resource of the Fearbulg, it's on Iokade. He is the greatest king of all of them. He has bountiful harvests, which signify great power. He had enough strength to have peace, stability, justice before an invasion. It took literal gods to bring him down.
Okay, 6.
I was thinking 5.
Okay, so that is an 11 in royal power. Infamy.
Did you find anything scandalous or horrific?
No.
No.
0. Oath of devotion.
He married a literal earth goddess.
10.
Yeah.
That's a 20 in Oath of Devotion. Bardic Inspiration.
He had a pretty, you just heard it. He had a pretty full, interesting life and a very horrific death. I've never heard of anyone being dead by magical dehydration. That's a first for me.
I'm thinking a 6.
I honestly don't know this one. He's just weird. I'll go with a 4.
Well, that's a 10 in Bardic Inspiration. And Legacy.
I mean, spoiler alert, the Fearbulg give way the Tuatha De.
5.
You're giving him anything?
I mean, 1.
I'm giving him nothing.
That's a 1 in Legacy. Actually, no, 0. That's a 0 in Legacy. With an 11 in Royal Power, a 0 in Infamy, a 20 in Oath of Devotion, a 10 in Bardic Inspiration, a 0 in Legacy, gives him a total of 41 points, which gives him 41 points.
So, points don't matter. If you read about Iokade, you would think he should be placed in the Hall of Legends. Or is he just good enough to be an NPC? Or is he horrible enough that we hate him for who knows what reason, that he would be burned at the stake?
Lesser noble.
Yeah, yeah. Easy.
That's an easy one. All right.
Easy money. That will bring us to the end of our story today. Let us know what you thought of the story. You can reach us on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky. If you enjoy our storytelling, we have some premium episodes for your pleasure if you become a member of our nobility, signing up at thequestforpower.com. If that's not your thing, just give us 5 stars on whatever review platform you use for podcasts. We'll help us out, get the word out. If you like us and you want us to grow, put more episodes out. And next episode, we're going to finish with the first battle, I should say, of Moytura and deal with its aftermath and raid another king, I should say. With that, the king is dead.
Long live the king.